can conceive of a national destiny which meets the responsibilities of today and measures up to the possibilities of tomorrow. Behold a republic resting securely upon the mountain of eternal truth. A republic applying in practice and proclaiming to the world the self-evident proposition that all men are created equal, that they're endowed with inalienable rights, that governments are instituted among men to secure these rights, and that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. Behold a republic in which civil and religious liberty stimulate all to earnest endeavor, and in which the law restrains every hand uplifted for a neighbor's injury. A republic in which every citizen is a sovereign, but in which no one cares to wear a crown. Behold a republic standing erect while empires all around are bowed beneath the weight of their own armaments. A republic which shakes thrones and dissolves aristocracy by its silent example and gives light and inspiration to those who sit in darkness. Behold a republic gradually but surely becoming the supreme moral factor in the world's progress and the accepted arbiter of the world's disputes. A republic whose history, like the path of its justice, is as the shining light that shineth more and more unto the perfect day. Behold a republic.
The powers that pray are united against us. The powers that pray pay no heed to a question of partisanship. These men, the big bosses of the political field, the beneficiaries of privilege in the field of industry, the men who represent that sinister alliance between crooked politics and crooked business, which has done more than anything else for the corruption of American life, are united as one man against the genuine rule of the people themselves. The privileged classes, the representatives of special privilege, of special interests, can always make terms with a boss or bosses. They can make terms with the bosses who dominate the Republican Party. They can make terms with the bosses who dominate the Democratic Party. But they can't make terms with the people. The fundamental motive that induces them to act as they have acted in this manner is because they dread you. They dread you, the people. You and those like you who make up the people of the United States. They know that their time has come if once the people obtain real power.
Political parties exist to secure responsible government and to execute the will of the people. Instead of instruments to promote the general welfare, they have become the tools of corrupt interests which use them impartially to serve their selfish purposes. Behind the ostensible government sits enthroned an invisible government, owing no allegiance and acknowledging no responsibility to the people. To destroy this invisible government, to dissolve the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics, is the first task of the statesmanship of the day.
The world war in which we are engaged in is on such a tremendous scale that we must readjust practically the whole nation's social and economic structure from a peace to a war basis. War means victory for our cause or danger to the very existence of our nation. Our republic, the freedom of the world, progress and civilization hang in the balance. We dare not fail. We will win.
Nationality is the call of the hearts of liberated peoples, and the dream of those to whom freedom becomes an undying cause. It's the guiding light, the song, the prayer, the consolation for our own people, although we were never assured indivisible union until the Civil War was fought. Can any red-blooded American consent now, when we have come to understand its priceless value, to merge our nationality into internationality? Out of the threats against orderly government and the assault on our present-day civilization, I think, sirs, I can see the opening way for America. We must preserve the inheritance and cling to just government. We do not need and we do not mean to live within and for ourselves alone, but we do mean to hold our ideals safe from foreign incursion. I do not believe, senators, that it's going to break the heart of the world to make this covenant right, or at least free it from perils which would endanger our own independence. But it were better to witness this rhetorical tragedy than to destroy the soul of this great republic. It's a very alluring thing, senators, to do what the world has never done before. No republic has ever permanently survived. They have flashed, illumined, and advanced the world, and then faded or crumbled. I want to be a contributor to the abiding republic. None of us today can be sure that it shall abide for generations to come, but we may hold it unshaken for our day and pass it on to the next generation preserved in its integrity. This is the unending call of duty to men of every civilization. It is distinctly the American call to duty to every man who believes we have come the nearest the dependable popular government the world has yet witnessed. We're 100 million or more today, and if the miracle of the first century of national life may be repeated in the second, the millions of today will be the myriads of the future. I like to think, sirs, that out of the discovered soul of the Republic, through our preservative actions in this supreme moment of human progress, we shall hold the word American the proudest boast of citizenship in all the world.
According to the tables which we have assembled, it is our estimate that 4% of the American people own 85% of the wealth of America, and that over 70% of the people of America don't own enough to pay the debt that they owe. How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat? The only way you'll ever be able to feed the balance of the people is to make that man come back and bring back some of that grub he ain't got no business with. How are you going to feed the balance of the people? What's Morgan and Baruch and Rockefeller and Mellon going to do with all that grub? They can't eat it. They can't wear the clothes. They can't live in the house. Give them a yacht. Give them a pilot.
Send him to Reno and give him a new wife. But when they've got everything on the God's living earth that they can eat, they can wear, they can live in, all that their children can live in and wear and eat, and all their children can use, then we got to call Mr. Morgan and Mr. Mellon and Mr. Rockefeller back here. Come back here. Well, that stuff back on this table here that you took away from you. You don't need. Something else for the American people to consume, and that's the problem. We're not going to destroy the Gulf Refining Company. We're not going to destroy the Standard Oil Company. But we're going to say that the limit of any one man's stock ownership in the Standard Oil Company is from $3 to $5 million to that individual, and that the balance of the people of America own the balance of what the Standard Oil Company is. Then, we start from the bottom, that the 25 or more million American families shall have a homestead, a home, and the comforts of a home, including an automobile and a radio, the things it takes in that house to live on. We say to America, 125 million, none shall be too big, none shall be too poor, none shall work too much, none shall be idle. No luxurious mansions empty. None walking straight. None in poverty. None in happiness. None in want. But in the land blessed by the smile of the Creator, with everything to be consumed, to be eaten, to be worn, that America will become a land sharing the fruitful land. Not for the favored few, not to satisfy greed, but that all may live in the land in which the Lord has provided an abundance sufficient for the luxury and convenience of the people in general. That's right. And the masses of America, 75 to 80 to 85% of the people, not only give up their property year after year, but they go further and further and further into economic slavery, to where the flesh and blood of the born and the unborn will never be able to raise the debt, let alone come back and rescue the property that they've lost from these depressions. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party were just like the old patent medicine drama that used to come around our country. He had two bottles of medicine. One of those bottles of medicine was called Hypopalor. And another one of those bottles of medicine was called Lopapahar. Finally, somebody around that said, is there any difference in these medicines? So he said, considerable. They're both good, but they're different. He said that Hypopalorum is made from the bark off the tree that we take from the top down. And that Lopapahiram is made from the bark that we take from the root up. And the only difference that I have found between the Democratic leadership and the Republican leadership was that one of them was skinning from the ankle up and the other from the ear down when I got to Congress.
There is written in the Constitution of the United States that Congress has the right to coin, issue, and regulate the value of money. That's good Americanism, and it's good enough for me. Every every politician today in the Democratic or Republican ranks sits upon one of the thrones of the mighty, doesn't believe in that part of the Constitution. They don't want to believe in that part of the Constitution. They believe that the Federal Reserve Bank has the right to coin and regulate the value of money. They're not even Americans. I come before you today. I wish to leave this thought with you. That in each congressional district, we will endorse a candidate who can rise above his party and put patriotism first. He may be a Democrat or a Republican or whatnot, but we're through with the sham battle of politicians, and now we're on our own. Therefore, under your congressional district presidents, form your battalions, take up the shield of your defense, unsheathe the sword of your truth, and carry on so that the communists, on the one hand, cannot scourge us, and that the modern capitalists, on the other, cannot plague us.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power and our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power. Against economic tyranny such as this, the American citizen can only appeal to the organized power of government. We well remember that the collapse of 1929 showed up the despotism for what it was, and the election of 1932 was the people's mandate to end it, and under that mandate it is being ended. It is not alone a war against want and destitution and economic demoralization. It is more than that. It is a war for the survival of democracy. We are fighting to save a great and precious form of government.
I appeared before the Congressional Committee, the highest representation of the American people, under subpoena to tell what I knew of activities, which I believe might lead to an attempt to set up a fascist dictatorship. The plan as outlined to me was to form an organization of veterans, to use as a bluff, or as a club at least, to intimidate the government and break down our democratic institutions. The upshot of the whole thing was that I was supposed to lead an organization of 500,000 men, which would be able to take over the functions of government.
It was in those days, my friends, that we feared fear. That was why we fought fear. And today, my friends, we have won against the most dangerous of our foes. We have conquered fear. But I cannot with candor tell you that all is well with the world. Clouds of suspicion, tides of ill will and intolerance gather darkly in many places. But the rush of modern civilization itself has raised for us new difficulties, new problems, which must be solved if we are to preserve to the United States the political and the economic freedom for which Washington and Jefferson planned and fought. That very word, freedom, in itself and of necessity suggests freedom from some restraining power. In 1776, we sought freedom from the tyranny of a political autocracy, from the 18th century royalists who held special privileges from the crown. It was to perpetuate their privilege that they governed without the consent of the governed, that they denied the right of free assembly and free speech, that they restricted the worship of God, that they put the average man's property and the average man's life in pawn to the mercenaries of dynastic power, that they regimented the people. And so it was to win freedom from the tyranny of political autocracy that the American Revolution was fought. That victory gave the business of governing into the hands of the average man, who won the right with his neighbors to make and order his own destiny through his own government. Political tyranny was wiped out at Philadelphia on July 4th, 1776. But since that struggle, man's inventive genius released new forces in our land. Forces which reordered the lives of our people. The age of machinery, of railroads, of steam and electricity, the telegraph and the radio, mass production, mass distribution, all of these combined to bring forward a new civilization, and with it a problem for those who sought to remain free. For out of this modern civilization, economic royalists formed new dynasties. New kingdoms were built upon concentration of control over material things. Through new uses of corporations and banks and securities, new machinery of industry and agriculture, of labor and capital, all undreamed of by the fathers, the whole structure of modern life was impressed into this royal service. There was no place among this royalty for our many thousands of small businessmen and merchants who sought to make a worthy use of the American system of initiative and profit. They were no more free than the worker or the farmer. they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution. But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for. Now, as always, for over a century and a half, the flag, the Constitution, stand against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike. And the flag and the Constitution stand for democracy, not tyranny, for freedom, not subjection. And so it was natural and perfectly human that the privileged princes of these new economic dynasties, bursting for power, reached out for control over government itself. They created a new despotism and wrapped it in the robe of legal sanctions. In its service, new mercenaries sought to regiment the people, their labor, their property. And as a result, the average man once more confronts the problem that faced the Minuteman of 76.
Never before, since Jamestown and Plymouth Rock, has our American civilization been in such danger as now.
The hours that men and women work, the wages they receive, the condition of their labor, these had passed beyond the control of the people and were imposed by this new industrial dictatorship. The savings of the average family, the capital of the small businessman, the investment set aside for old age, other people's money. These were the tools which the new economic royalty used to dig itself in. Private enterprise, indeed, became too private. It became privileged enterprise, not free enterprise. For too many of us, the political equality we once had won was meaningless in the face of economic inequality. A small group had concentrated into their own hands an almost complete control over other people's property, other people's money, other people's labor, other people's lives. For too many of us throughout the land, life was no longer free, liberty no longer real. Men could no longer follow the pursuit of happiness. Against economic tyranny such as this, the American citizen could only appeal to the organized power of government. We well remember that the collapse of 1929 showed up the despotism for what it was. And the election of 1932 was the people's mandate to end it, and under that mandate, it is being ended.
Friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking.
talk with the comparatively few who understand the mechanics of banking, but more particularly with the overwhelming majority of you who use banks for the making of deposits and the drawing of checks. First of all, let me state the simple fact that when you deposit money in a bank, the bank does not put the money into a safe deposit vault. A comparatively small part of the money that you put into the bank is kept in currency. In other words, the total amount of all the currency in the country is only a comparatively small proportion of the total deposits in all the banks of the country. We have had a bad banking situation. Some of our bankers have shown themselves either incompetent or dishonest in their handling of the people's funds. They had used the money entrusted to them in speculation and unwise loans.
The second step we have taken in the restoration of normal business enterprise has been to clean up thoroughly unwholesome conditions in the field of investment. In this, we have had assistance from many bankers and businessmen, most of whom recognize the past evils in the banking system. Evils in the sale of securities. Evils in the deliberate encouragement of stock gambling. Evils in the sale of unsound mortgages. Evils in many other ways in which the public lost literally billions of dollars. The country now enjoys the safety of bank savings under the new banking laws, the careful checking of new securities under the Securities Act, and the curtailment of rank stock speculation through the Securities Exchange Act. I sincerely hope that as a result, people will be discouraged in unhappy efforts to get rich quick by speculating in securities. For the average person almost always loses. Only a very small minority of the people of this country believe in gambling as a substitute for the old philosophy of Benjamin Franklin that the way to wealth is through work. And under these codes, in the industry's cover, child labor has been eliminated. The work day and the work week have been shortened. Minimum wages have been established and other wages adjusted towards the rising standard of living. For the emergency purpose of the NRA was to put men to work. Since its creation, more than 4 million persons have been re-employed, in great part through the cooperation of American business brought about under the code. Benefits of this industrial recovery program have come not only to labor in the form of new jobs, in relief from overwork, in relief from underpay, but also to the owners and managers of industry. And our first problem was, of course, the banking situation. Because, as you know, the banks had collapsed. Some banks could not be saved, but the great majority of them, either through their own resources or with government aid, have been restored to complete public confidence. This has given safety to millions of depositors in these banks. We are bringing order out of the old chaos with a greater certainty of the employment of labor at a reasonable wage and of more business at a fair profit. In our effort for recovery, we have avoided, on the one hand, the theory that business should and must be taken over into an all-embracing government. We have avoided, on the other hand, the equally untenable theory that it is an interference with liberty to offer reasonable help when private enterprise is in need of help. My friends, I still believe in ideals. I am not for a return to that definition of liberty under which for many years a free people were being gradually regimented into the service of the privileged few. I prefer, and I am sure you prefer, that broader definition of liberty under which we are moving forward to greater freedom, to greater security for the average man than he has ever known before in the history of America.
This is a fight between a slave world and a free world. Just as in the United States in 1862, we could not remain half slave and half free, we who live in the United States may think there is nothing very revolutionary about freedom of religion, freedom of expression, and freedom from fear, freedom from the secret police. But when we begin to think about the significance of freedom from want for the average man, then we know that the revolution of the past 150 years has not been completed, either here in the United States or any place else in the world. We know that this revolution cannot stop until freedom from want has actually been attained. As we begin the final stages of this fight to the death between the free world and the slave world, it is worthwhile to refresh our minds about the march of freedom for the common man. The idea of freedom, the freedom that we in the United States know and love so well, is derived from the Bible, with its extraordinary emphasis on the dignity of the individual. The prophets of the Old Testament were the first to preach social justice. But that which was sensed by the prophets many centuries before Christ was not given complete and powerful political expression until our nation here in the United States was formed as a federal union a century and a half ago. Even then, the march of the common people had just begun. Down the years, the people of the United States have moved steadily forward in the practice of democracy. When the freedom-loving people march, when the farmers have an opportunity to buy land at reasonable prices and sell the produce of their land through their own organization, when workers have the opportunity to form unions, bargain through them collectively, when the children of all the people have an opportunity to attend schools which teach them the truth of the real world, when these opportunities are open to everyone, then the world moves straight ahead. But in those countries where the ability has been recently acquired, or where the people have had no long experience in governing themselves on the basis of their own thinking, it is easy for demagogues to arise and prostitute the mind of the common man to their own base ends. Such a demagogue may get financial help from some person of wealth. With this backing, the demagogue may dominate the minds of the people, and from whatever degree of freedom they have, lead them back into a most degraded slavery. The demagogue is the curse of the modern world. And of all the demagogues, the worst are those financed by wealthy men who sincerely believe that their wealth is likely to be safer if they can hire men with political it to change the signposts and lure the people back into slavery. Unfortunately for the wealthy men who finance movements of this sort, as well as for the people themselves, a successful demagogue is a powerful genie. who, when once let out of his bottle, refuses to obey anyone's command. As long as his spell holds, he defies God himself, and Satan is turned loose on the world. So also is the doctrine that one race or one class is by heredity superior, and that all other races or classes are supposed to be slaves. All the rest are stooges. They are stooges who have been mentally and politically degraded, and who feel that they can get square with the world only by mentally and politically degrading other people. These stooges are really psychopathic cases. Satan has turned loose upon us the insane. The search of the freedom, the march of freedom of the past 150 years has been a long, drawn-out people's revolution. In this great revolution of the people's revolution aims at peace and not at violence. But if the rights of the common man are attacked, it unleashes the ferocity of the she-bear who has lost a cub. The truth is that when the rights of the American people are transgressed, as these rights have been transgressed, the American people will fight with a relentless fury. The people are on the march toward an even fuller freedom than the most fortunate peoples of the world have hitherto enjoyed. The people in their millennial and revolutionary march toward manifesting here on earth the dignity that is in every human soul hold as their credo the four freedoms enunciated by President Roosevelt in his message to Congress on January 6, 1941. And now as we move forward toward realizing the four freedoms of this people's revolution, I would like to speak about four duties. It is my belief that every freedom, every right, every privilege has its price, its corresponding duty, without which it cannot be enjoyed. The peace must mean a better standard of living for the common man, not merely in the United States and England, but also in India, Russia, China, and Latin America. Some have spoken of the American century. I say that the century on which we are entering, the century which will come into being after this war, can be and must be the century of the common man. But there must be neither military nor economic imperialism. The methods of the 19th century will not work in the people's century, which is now about to begin. International cartels that serve American greed and German will to power must go. Cartels in the peace to come must be subjected to international control for the common man, as well as being under adequate control by the respective home governments. With international monopoly pools under control, it will be possible for inventions to serve all the people instead of only the few. There can be no privileged people. We ourselves in the United States are no more a master race than the Nazis. And we cannot perpetuate economic warfare without planting the seeds of military warfare. We must use our power at the peace table to build an economic peace that is charitable and enduring.
We cannot allow the natural passions and prejudices of other peoples to lead our country to destruction. When hostilities commenced in Europe in 1939, it was realized by these groups that the American people had no intention of entering the war. They knew it would be worse than useless to ask us for a declaration of war at that time. But they believed that this country could be enticed into the war in very much the same way that it was enticed into the last one. They planned, first, to prepare the United States for foreign war under the guise of American defense. Second, to involve us in the war, step by step, without our realization. Third, to create a series of incidents which would force us into the actual conflict. These plans were, of course, to be covered and assisted by the full power of their propaganda. Our theaters soon became filled with plays portraying the glory of war. Newsreels lost all semblance of objectivity. Newspapers and magazines began to lose advertising if they carried anti-war articles. A smear campaign was instituted against individuals who opposed intervention. The terms fifth columnist, traitor, Nazi, anti-Semitic were thrown ceaselessly at anyone who dared to suggest that it was not to the best interests of the United States to enter war. Men lost their jobs if they were frankly anti-war. Many others dared no longer speak. Before long, lecture halls that were open to advocates of war were closed to speakers who opposed it. A fear campaign was inaugurated. Propaganda was in full swing. Ever since its inception, our arms program has been laid out for the purpose of carrying on the war in Europe, far more than for the purpose of building an adequate defense for America. Only one thing holds this country from war today. That is the rising opposition of the American people. Our system of democracy and representative government is on test today as it has never been before.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
We needed one thing which our own resources could not make available to us. That vital need was the information available in Washington from the intercepted dispatches which told when and where Japan would probably strike. I did not get this information. It is my conviction that action by the Navy Department in furnishing me the information from the intercepted messages would have altered the events of December 7, 1941.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid many fold, and the end is not yet. With this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction to supplement the growing power of our armed forces. In their present form, these bombs are now in production, and even more powerful forms are in development. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East. Prepared to destroy more rapidly and completely every productive enterprise the Japanese have in any city. We shall destroy their docks, their factories, and their communications. We shall destroy the force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, but that attack is only a warning of things to come.
We are now prepared to destroy more rapidly and completely every productive enterprise in any city. We are now prepared to destroy more rapidly and completely in any city. In any city. In any city. We shall destroy their docks and their communications, their factories. If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth. Behind this air attack will follow sea and land forces in such numbers and power as they have not yet seen, and with the fighting skill of which they are already well aware. The thing which we have learned now and should never forget is this: that a society of self-governing men is more powerful, more enduring, more creative than any other kind of society, however disciplined, however centralized. We know now that the basic proposition of the worth and dignity of man is not a sentimental aspiration or a vain hope or a piece of rhetoric. It is the strongest, most creative force now present in this world. Our victory in Europe was more than a victory of arms. It was a victory of one way of life over another. It was a victory of an ideal founded on the rights of the common man, on the dignity of the human being, on the conception of the state as the servant and not the master of its people. A free people showed that it was able to defeat professional soldiers whose only moral arms were obedience and the worship of force.
We take you now to Washington.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
For we are opposed around the world
by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed.
Well, first of all, the Federal Reserve is an independent agency, and that means basically that there is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take.
The President's car is now turning onto Elm Street, and it will be only a matter of minutes before he arrives at the trademark. I was on Stemmons Freeway earlier, and even the freeway was jam-packed with spectators waiting their chance to see the President as he made his way toward the trademark. It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by, please. There has been a shooting. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound. The President's car is now going past me. The limousine is now traveling at a very high rate of speed. Secret Service men standing up in the limousine. They are armed with submachine guns. It appears as though someone in the limousine might have been hit by the gunfire.
The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You can see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car. We understand Governor and Mrs. Connolly are in the car with President and Mrs. Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody's been hit, but apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong. I'm in behind the motorcade, trying to follow them. It looks as though they're going to Parkland Hospital. Secret Service man is still spread eagle over whoever is in the car, the President and Mrs. Kennedy, and as we understand, Governor and Mrs. Connolly. At this point, it looks as though it could have been one or two or even all of the people within the car may have been the victims, may have been struck by shots. We don't know.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time.
It is my duty to the American people to report that renewed hostile actions against United States ships on the high seas in the Gulf of Tonkin have today required me to order the military forces of the United States to take action in reply.
Johnson said, we may have to escalate, and he put forward a resolution, the language of which gave complete authority to the president to take the nation to war. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution. And events afterwards showed that our judgment that we've been attacked that day was wrong. It didn't happen. It didn't happen.
Colonel North, in your work at the NSC, were you not assigned at one time to work on plans for the continuity of government in the event of a major disaster?
Mr. Chairman,
I believe that question touches upon a highly sensitive and classified area, so may I request that you not touch upon that, sir?
I was particularly concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I read in Miami papers and several others that there had been a plan developed by that same agency a contingency plan in the event of emergency that would suspend the American Constitution. And I was deeply concerned about it and wondered if that was the area in which he had worked.
May I most respectfully request that that matter not be touched upon at this stage.
What is at stake is more than one small country. It is a big idea, a new world order. Out of these troubled times, our fifth objective, a new world order, can emerge, a new era.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order. A world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order.
The Federal Reserve is an independent agency. The Federal Reserve is an independent agency. The Federal Reserve is an independent agency. And that means basically that there is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take. There is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take. No other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take.
Do you feel that the Federal Reserve is operating with too much secrecy and too much refusal to disclose information that you have to other federal banking regulators?
The Federal Reserve has made enormous strides in the last year under my chairmanship to expand the information that we release. We release monthly information on all the various programs that we have. We've developed a website and a monthly report that involves all kinds of information. We think we are quite transparent. We are happy to work with Congress if they have further concerns about any of our programs. We are more than happy to work with you to make sure that you're comfortable, that they are well managed and are serving a public purpose.
Do you think it would cause problems for the Fed or for the economy if that legislation was to pass?
My concern about the legislation is that if the GAO is auditing not only the operational aspects of our programs and the details of the programs, but is making judgments about our policy decisions, that would effectively be a takeover of monetary policy by the Congress, a repudiation of the independence of the Federal Reserve, which would be highly destructive to the stability of the financial system, the dollar, and our national economic situation.
There is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take.
Transparency in monetary policy is a goal we should all support. I've often wondered why Congress has so willingly given up this prerogative over monetary policy. Congress, in essence, has ceded total control of the value of our money to a secretive central bank. Congress created the Federal Reserve, yet it had no constitutional authority to do so. We forget that those powers not explicitly granted to the Congress by the Constitution are inherently denied to the Congress, and thus the authority to establish a central bank is never given. Congress, although not by law, essentially has given up all its oversight responsibilities over the Fed. There are no true audits. Congress knows nothing of the conversations, the plans, and the action taken in concert with other central banks. We get less and less information regarding the money supply each year, especially now that the role the Fed plays in the President's secretive working group on financial markets goes essentially unnoticed by Congress. The Federal Reserve shows no willingness to inform Congress voluntarily about how often the working group meets, what action it takes that affects the financial markets, or why it takes these actions. But all these actions directed by the Federal Reserve alter the purchasing power of our money.
and that purchasing power is always reduced. The dollar today is worth only 4 cents compared to the dollar that the Federal Reserve started with in 1913. This has significant consequences on our economy and our political stability. All paper currencies are vulnerable to collapse, and history is replete with examples of great suffering caused by these collapses, especially to the nation's poor and the middle class. This can lead to political turmoil as well. Even before a currency collapses, the damage done by a fiat system is significant. Our monetary system insidiously transfers wealth from the poor and the middle class to the privileged rich. Wages never keep up with profits on Wall Street and the banks, thus sowing the seeds of class and discontent. When economic trouble hits, free markets and free trade are often blamed, while the harmful effects of a fiat monetary system are ignored. We deceive ourselves that all is well with the economy and ignore the fundamental flaws that are a source of growing discontent among the various groups. Few understand that our consumption and apparent wealth is dependent on a current account deficit running at approximately $800 billion a year. This deficit shows that much of our prosperity is based on borrowing rather than a true increase in production. This phenomenon is not seen as a consequence of the international fiat monetary system where the United States government benefits as the issuer of the world reserve currency. We must address the important consequences of the Fed manipulation of interest rates. When interest rates are artificially low, below market rates, insidious malinvestment and excessive indebtedness inevitably brings about the economic downturns that everyone dreads. We look at GDP figures and reassure ourselves that all is well, yet a growing number of Americans still do not enjoy the high standard of living that monetary inflation brings to the privileged few.
The $700 billion bailout for Wall Street is being driven by fear, not fact. This is too much money in too short a time going to too few people while too many questions remain unanswered. Why aren't we having hearings on the plan we just received? Why aren't we questioning the underlying premise of the need for a bailout with taxpayers' money? Why have we not even considered any alternatives other than to give $700 billion to Wall Street? Why aren't we asking Wall Street to clean up its own mess? Why aren't we passing new laws to stop the speculation which triggered this? Why aren't we putting up new regulatory structures to protect the investors? Why aren't we directly helping homeowners with their debt burden? Why aren't we helping American families faced with bankruptcy? Why aren't we reducing debts for Main Street instead of Wall Street? Isn't it time for fundamental change in our debt-based monetary system so we can free ourselves from manipulation by the Federal Reserve and the banks? The banks have shown that they can't be trusted with the American economy. We also have to address the issue of the fractional reserve system, which is how banks create money out of thin air. And then as they do that, they've created the conditions where we've had this kind of Ponzi scheme collapsing. Is this the United States Congress or the Board of Directors of Goldman Sachs? Federal Reserve is no more federal than Federal Express. But yet it has the power to determine the direction of use of money in our economy. In 1913, the money power of the country was taken away from the people in the Federal Reserve Act. By constitutional privilege, it belongs with the Congress, but it was given up. If we could take that power back and put the Federal Reserve under Treasury, we start to be in a position of being able to control monetary policy on behalf of the United States people.
I rise, obviously, in strong support of this legislation. I don't know how anybody could be against transparency, and they want secrecy, especially when the secrecy is to protect individuals who deal in trillions of dollars much bigger than what the Congress does. And these trillions of dollars bail out all the wealthy, rich people, the banks and the big corporations, international, overseas banks, bailing out Europe, dealing with central banks around the Europe. And to say that we should have secrecy and say that it's political to have transparency, well, it's very political when you have a Federal Reserve that can bail out one company and not another company. That's pretty political. I think when people talk about independence and having this privacy of the central bank, means they want secrecy. And secrecy is not good. We should have privacy for the individual, but we should have openness of government all the time. And we've drifted a long way from that.
The Fed clearly is out of control. We have to find mechanisms to bring it back under control. And I think we could start by looking at that Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Absolutely disastrous for this country. Fed has to be brought back under the control of the Congress, which has the ability to do it.
There is no authority in the Constitution authorizing a central bank, which means there should be no Federal Reserve System.
The productive capacity of this nation is not being used. It's withering. We have to put America back to work. Our program actually is pretty simple. Jobs, jobs, jobs. Put people back to work with good paying jobs. How do you do that? You go back to that old time religion of FDR, reflected in the New Deal. You rebuilt America. There's over $1.6 trillion in infrastructure needs that are unmet, that can't be met by local or state governments. Wall Street is a place of bears and bulls. It's not smart to force taxpayers to dance with bears or to follow closely behind the bulls.
The bill essentially removes the prohibitions against a full audit. To audit, we should know what kind of transactions are. We should know about the deals that they made when they were fixing the price of LIBOR. These are the kind of things that have gone on for years and we have no access to.
We really have the opportunity to take control of our own destiny again. But we can't go back to the same old. Trickle down economics, the trickle never gets down. The invisible hand of the marketplace is in the pockets of the American taxpayers. Let's rebuild America, let's reclaim our economic destiny, and let's do it as a Congress united, working with the new administration. Thank you.
The Constitution is very clear who has the responsibility. It is time that we repeal this prohibition against the full audit of the Federal Reserve. We deserve it. The American people deserve it. And that's what they're asking for. They're sick and tired of what happened in the bailout and where the wealthy got bailed out and the poor lost their jobs and they lost their homes. And I yield back.
I once put it rather pungently, and I was flattered that the British Foreign Secretary repeated this, as follows. Earlier times, it was easier to control 1 million people, literally. It was easier to control 1 million people than physically to kill 1 million people. Today, it is infinitely easier to kill 1 million people than to control 1 million people. It is infinitely easier to kill 1 million people than to control 1 million people.
When I was growing up, my father, who had only an eighth grade education, worked for the Minneapolis Street Department. He told me one time when I was a teenager, he said, "All politicians are a bunch of crooks." And I said to my dad, "Well, come on, Dad, you can't make a blanket statement like that. They can't all be." And he said, "Yes, they are. You know why?" And I said, "Why?" And in his simple way, he said, "Because they pay $1 million for a job that only pays $100,000." which none of us in the private sector would ever do that. You're not going to pay more money than what you're going to earn doing the job.
I want to thank the Secretary of State and Secretary of Treasury for being here, both of whom lead important parts of our war. I want to thank the Director of the FBI and the Director of the CIA for waging an incredibly important part on the two-front war, one overseas and a front here at home. We've seen the enemy in the murder of thousands of innocent, unsuspecting people. They recognize no barrier of morality. They have no conscience. As of today, we're changing the laws. This new law that I signed today will allow surveillance of all communications, including emails, the internet, and cell phones. As of today, we'll be able to better meet the technological challenges posed by this proliferation of communications technology. This bill met with overwhelming agreement in Congress because it upholds and respects the civil liberties guaranteed by our Constitution. This legislation is essential not only to pursuing and punishing terrorists, but also preventing more atrocities in the hands of the evil ones. It is now my honor to sign into law the USA Patriot Act of 2001.
As evidence emerges about the backgrounds of those convicted of terrorist offences, it is clear that many of them were initially influenced by preachers who claim not to encourage violence. We know this worldview, the peddling of lies, that 9/11 was somehow a Jewish plot, or that the 7/7 London attacks were staged. The idea that Muslims are persecuted all over the world as a deliberate act of Western policy. And we must stop the so-called non-violent extremists. We must be clear, to defeat the ideology of extremism, we need to deal with all forms of extremism, not just violent extremism. Governments that only govern for some of their people cause deep resentment. For our part in the United Kingdom, we are introducing new powers to strengthen our ability to seize passports and stop suspects from travelling, to allow us to strip British identity from dual nationals and temporarily prevent some British nationals getting back into our country, to ensure that airlines comply with our no-fly lists and security screening requirements, and to enable our police and our security services to apply for stronger locational constraints on those in the UK who pose a risk. My message today is simple. We are facing an evil against which the whole of the world should unite.
A new world order.
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 The new world order.
A new world order.
The new world order.
Mr. President, could you please react to the reports of secret government surveillance of phones and internets? And can you also assure Americans that the government, your government, doesn't have some massive secret database of all their personal online information and activities?
Yeah. The programs that have been discussed over the last couple of days in the press are secret in the sense that they're classified. But they're not secret in the sense that every member of Congress has been briefed on this program. When it comes to telephone calls, nobody is listening to your telephone calls. That's not what this program's about. But I think it's important to recognize that you can't have 100% security and also then have 100% privacy and zero inconvenience. You know, we're going to have to make some choices.
My name's Ed Snowden. I work for Booz Allen Hamilton as an infrastructure analyst for NSA. NSA, and the intelligence community in general, is focused on getting intelligence wherever it can, by any means possible.
By any means possible. By any means possible.
Originally, we saw that focus very narrowly tailored as foreign intelligence gathered overseas. Now, increasingly, we see that it's happening domestically. And to do that, the NSA specifically targets the communications of everyone. It ingests them by default. It collects them in its system, and it filters them, and it analyzes them, and it measures them, and it stores them.
Why should people care about surveillance?
Because even if you're not doing anything wrong, you're being watched and recorded. And the storage capability of these systems increases every year consistently by orders of magnitude. To where it's getting to the point you don't have to have done anything wrong. You simply have to eventually fall under suspicion from somebody, even by a wrong call. And then they can use the system to go back in time and scrutinize every decision you've ever made, every friend you've ever discussed something with, and attack you on that basis to sort of derive suspicion from an innocent life and paint anyone in the context of a wrongdoer.
I take the threat of terrorism seriously, and I think we all do. And I think it's really disingenuous for the government to invoke and sort of scandalize our memories, to sort of exploit the national trauma that we all suffered together and worked so hard to come through, to justify programs that have never been shown to keep us safe, but cost us liberties and freedoms that we don't need to give up, and our Constitution says we should not give up.
The greatest fear that I have regarding the outcome for America of these disclosures is that nothing will change. People will see in the media all of these disclosures. They'll know the lengths that the government is going to grant themselves powers to create greater control over American society and global society. But they won't be willing to take the risks necessary to stand up and fight to change things, to force their representatives to actually take a stand in their interests. And the months ahead, the years ahead, it's only gonna get worse. A new leader will be elected. They'll flip the switch, say that because of the crisis, because of the dangers that we face in the world, you know, some new and unpredicted threat, we need more authority, we need more power, and there will be nothing that people can do at that point to oppose it, and it'll be turnkey tyranny.
There are at least two ways in which sit-ins and civil disobedience, at least two major ways in which it can occur. One, when a law exists, is promulgated, which is totally unacceptable to people, and they violate it again and again and again till it's rescinded. That brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. That doesn't mean that you have to break anything. 1,000 people sitting down someplace, not letting anybody by, not letting anything happen, can stop any machine, including this machine, and it will stop.
I have a dream. One day, this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the brotherhood. I have a dream. My four little children one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream. That one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain. And the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. And all flesh shall see it together.
I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution. And so it is to the printing press that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.